Central figures in theoretical physics over the last 50 years, I guess. So it's very hard to introduce someone like Girard, who is both a giant in our field and an extremely modest and approachable person. It's a very rare combination, but let me try. So, besides his physics, he's a very accomplished musician, cartoonist, curator of an interesting website, and has no doubt many talents I'm not aware of. But I can just say, sort of personally, I became aware of Girard when I was a PhD student in London, and that was, I guess, soon after the solidification of the Standard Model and verification of the W and Z bosons and so on. So Girard has unusual qualities, both technical brilliance, so he really laid the foundations of the Standard Model by showing that gauge theories are renormalizable. But on the other hand, he's always been very bold. And I was so happy to see him resonate with our theme of simplicity in his title. And indeed, his papers are like this. When you read his papers, there will be a line, and this happened when I was a graduate student, you know, there was a line that said, of course, this is true, right? And that line you may spend a week or more wondering about why this was so obvious. but that's his style. He's bold not just in exposition of subjects, but also in challenging received wisdom. It was also, I hope you don't mind me saying this, but sometime later, you know, Girard was worried that supersymmetry might not actually make sense theoretically, and proposed certain flaws or possible problems, which, you know, caused people to react and try to show that it did make sense. But he's completely unafraid, and if you do have the privilege of discussing physics with him, you will find that rather forceful and clear answers will emerge very quickly. And again, this is a fantastic quality. So if you want to know whether what you're working on makes any sense, please try to explain it to Girard. So without any further ado, let me just say how privileged we are to have him here. He's been here already for more than a week. He's staying till Friday. We are going to have a discussion this afternoon, but this is restricted to the participants of this meeting. So either you sign up quickly or you will miss out. But we're really happy to have Girard. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Neil. I'm not sure I know the person who you're talking about, but I'm very happy to be here. I'm very happy to be here. I have been here many times. I know the Institute from the very beginning, and I saw it very quickly grow up with a fantastic reputation. Many of our colleagues don't consider themselves really up to date if you haven't visited this institute many times. And now, well, there was a special occasion. There were two meetings right after one another that sounded very interesting to me, so it was a good reason to pay another visit to the Parameter Institute. And I would have come here even more often if it wasn't a bit far away from the country where I wanted to raise my children. That's, I think, only reason why I'm here, not more often. And I was particularly intrigued by the title of the meeting that we are in now, because I've seen several meetings which were about complexity, and I always thought that when you use the word complexity, you are sweeping things under the rug that you don't talk about, and that you don't want to admit that a calculation is too difficult. But really, it should be the aim of physics to try to understand the simple underlying reasons and laws that govern our world, and this has always been my aim to try to contribute to that, to see how you can get some sort of unified picture and a general idea about how things work in the physical world. In particular, I focused on the world of tiny things, tiny elementary particles, tiny phenomena even much tinier than elementary particles. And in particular, the previous meeting was about cosmology. Now you think cosmology is the opposite, it's very large things, but at the same time, of course, also the physics of the tiniest things is equally important for cosmology. If not alone because the universe must have started very, very tiny, and only things even tinier than that could be responsible for the universe to get started in the first place and to take the shape that it has now. So all these things are very much subject of my mind. Now, I wanted to report here about what I found, what my opinion is about quantum mechanics. Again, this was intended to be a talk for specialists, for people who already know all the equations and just wanted to know a bit, to discuss some details of it. I see a very large audience here, but I know that most of you are physicists or in related fields, so I hope you won't mind too much to see some equations every now and then. So this is the set of subjects I want to talk about. I once heard a general saying that if you never give a talk, first you have to tell them what you're going to talk about. Then you tell them, and then you tell them what you talked about. And I'm not going to waste my time with the first chapter. I'm not going to tell you what I'm going to talk about. It's here on the list, and you will see what happens. So these are two gentlemen who have been thinking very deeply about the meaning of quantum mechanics. And David Bohm, the one on the right, also once visited our institute, and he gave long talks about his ideas about quantum mechanics, which I didn't understand very well. But there were some things that he's now very well known about, the notion of a pilot wave, the idea that that the way quantum mechanics basically started with Louis de Broglie, who had the idea of associating particles with waves. And he elaborated on that idea and found that somehow every particle must have its own pilot wave, and the equation of the wave are then part of the whole machinery of space and time and matter. I always thought these ideas, although it looked logical from a mathematical point of view to do things that way, it also looked very ugly to my mind. I don't really believe that nature cares anything about pilot waves, and that particles are things that have themselves being piloted. I found it very hard to believe that that would be the first principles on which the laws of nature should be based. Another person who was thinking along similar lines was John Bell, the person at the right, who also asked these questions: what can it possibly be that makes the physical world works the way it does? And in particular, what do the laws of quantum mechanics mean? How should I interpret these in a physically meaningful way? And in those days, it was very fashionable, or at least it was discussed a lot, to have some sort of mechanism that explains how quantum mechanics would somehow be generated out of some stochastic behavior of elementary units of matter. So you have particles that fill the entire universe, and these particles behave in a strange way, but somehow there could be other particles that are hidden from us that are participating in the interactions in such a way that quantum mechanics comes out as a statistical behavior of the object that we see. So those ideas were called the hidden variable models. And Bell, like many others, started to make models, and he couldn't get models that worked to his satisfaction. And so he did what many other physicists have also done earlier and later. When he couldn't do something, he wanted to make sure that it could not be done at all. Nobody should be able to do this. So then you try to prove that it cannot be done. That's called a no-go theorem. Now, in my career as physicist, I've encountered several other no-go theorems. People prove that whatever you want to do here is impossible. Don't even think of it. Just forget it. Do something better. All those no-go theorems usually go flat on their face at some point. Not because the theorems were wrong, but because the assumptions were wrong. That very often, just the one natural assumption that, of course, you start off with before you can do anything, you write down, and then the natural assumption is so natural that it doesn't need any further discussion, but that natural assumption turns out to be the weak spot, the Achilles tendon of that idea. And if you just make different assumptions, you can do exactly what you wanted to do. Anyway, Bell wrote down a no-go theorem, and his assumptions were minimal. And most philosophers in particular, when you talk with them, they say, of course those assumptions were correct. There's no doubt. If you want a hidden variable theory, it should obey certain conditions about locality and causality. And if you assume those, then Bell could prove that that would never generate quantum mechanics. But it is these assumptions about locality and causality where I think he made some assumptions which, to my mind, were not so solidly underpinned. And that's an assumption about how to formulate causality. And so I disbelieve his definition of causality. So anyway, I'm a stubborn man anyway, so even if someone says it's not possible, that's a good reason to work on that subject, because nobody else will be working on it anymore. So let's try to do it. So I start from the very other end. And let's consider the simplest possible system on which you can then subject the laws of quantum mechanics to see what happens. And the simplest possible system is something that is completely classical. And there is no question about what it does physically, between quotation marks, and how to solve its equations. It is so simple that you can see immediately how the equation should be solved, and that there is nothing further to be said about it. So there's no such thing as quantum mechanics in the formulation of this model that I'm going to show to you. There is no Hilbert space, no pilot wave, or anything of the sort. It is just a thing that can be subject to one mathematical procedure that many of us would not even think of, because the model is so easy. Why should you apply complicated mathematics to solve something that's easy? Well, I'll try to explain that to you. The model is a model that contains that describes a universe or a system or something that can be in n different states. And these states are what we call ontological. That is to say, they really take place. It's not something that is some abstraction or has some vague relation to the real thing. No, this is the real thing. The real thing is that the system can be in n states, and it is rolling from one state into the next. So this little arrow here tells you that this thing just rotates as a gear around, and after n steps, it comes back to its initial position. And the law is perhaps every second, every single time unit, you make one step. And after n seconds, you are back to where you were before. And that is the universe that I'm now going to describe. This is a simple universe, doesn't contain any physicists, doesn't contain any observers, it just contains states. The idea behind this is that the real universe might be something like this, so a thing that consists of states. The universe can evolve from one state into the next state according to some law. Now, the laws of the real universe are quite a bit more complicated than this, but you have to start somewhere. And what we do now is something that mathematicians are quite familiar with. It's not something that you have to dream up or from scratch. And that is that you write those things as states in a vector space. So I put these funny brackets around them. They are the Dirac brackets. And the Dirac brackets tell you, this is quantum mechanics. this is something important. You have, don't have to, shouldn't think too deeply about it because then you don't know what you're doing anymore. But in this case, they are just n vectors. And I choose the n vectors to be orthogonal to each other, so they form an n-dimensional world. And mathematicians like to do this. They also do this when they study the permutation group. The permutation group is something very similar to this. You have an object, think of Rubik's Cube as a nice example. You can make several moves in the Rubik's Cube. Every move is a permutation of the little cubicles that you have there. And certain permutations are allowed, other permutations are more difficult to obtain. And the question is how to solve the equations. What mathematicians then do is they turn the problem into a problem of vectors. And the reason for that is that these vectors can be superimposed. There's no good physical reason to superimpose the vectors, but there's a mathematical reason. You want to solve equations. For instance, the permutation group, if I have 2,000 objects, the permutation group contains not only 2,000 permutations, but 2,000 times 1999 times 1998. That's quite a lot of different permutations you can make, 2,000 factorial. So that problem can become pretty nasty. You can ask how many subgroups are there, what are the elements of those subgroups, and so on. In mathematics, you use matrices to solve such problems, because matrices can be diagonalized. And when you diagonalize a matrix, you can read off the trace of the matrix. What does that mean? The physical world just rotates, and that's it. So why should you use those matrices? Well, they are very handy if the problem becomes a little bit more complicated. So what you do in this case is you write the matrix. The matrix tells you that if your state was in state n at the point t, then it goes into a state n at the point t plus delta t. That position n will then be an operation acting on the original state. The operation is move the state one step along. So replace n by n plus 1. That's the operation. And that operation can be written as a matrix. And this is the matrix. So the matrix contains zeros and ones. And here you see that the one which was sitting here was moved one step down, two steps down, and so on. So this is the matrix. And now you can do something nice with the matrix. You can diagonalize the matrix and see what it does. And well, let's do that work. It's a little bit of work mathematically, but diagonalizing this matrix is not hard, I can tell you. The trick is to use a discrete Fourier transform, or finite Fourier transform this way. You have just n objects. So Fourier transforming a function that is a function of n objects is very simple. You just take the Fourier coefficients, which is e to the 2 pi I k n divided by big N. This means that this is how to do the finite Fourier transform. To get a state that's normalized, you have to divide by the square root of n, where n was the number of steps. And these are the so-called ontological states, n. And these, what are these states? Well, I call them energy states for very good reasons. They are big, because I'm going to write these as this Fourier transform. The nice thing about these Fourier transforms is that you can Fourier transform backwards as easy as forward. So when you switch the sign in this exponent here, you get the opposite. You can see how these n ontological states can be transformed back into the k states. So you can go from one space to the other space. What it really means is a rotation of these vectors. And this is just a fancy way to write down a rotation in vector space. And the n varies from 0 to capital N minus 1, because once you have capital N itself, that is equal to this position 0. But the k also runs from 0 to capital N minus 1. And you see the situation becomes very symmetric mathematically. Physically, it's totally different. Physically, the n states are the real states this universe can be in. These k states are some things that only happen in your imagination. But it's very useful, because you can take this matrix here and diagonalize it, and then you can make a next step. You can write it as e to the minus I h times delta t. Delta t is a time unit, but you can put delta t equal to 1. That doesn't change anything in the story. So just write this u as e to the power minus I times h. And then h becomes a rather crazy matrix, which all is element filled somehow. You have to solve this as an equation. If you see it for the first time, the equation seems to be hard, but actually by this Fourier transformation procedure, it's very easy to do so. So once you have, you ask how does this k look? Well, the permutation operator then just multiplies the state k by e to the I k. So it becomes a very easy multiplication in the coordinates of the k-space. And so now you can easily find out what the solution is. That you find this operator H as a matrix, and you find the eigenvalues of the operator. You can read them off directly, because the matrix in this basis becomes a diagonal matrix. So from the diagonals, you can immediately write out how to replace the matrix such that it becomes e to the minus I times something. And that something H is very easy. That matrix H is very easy to get. And H turns out to be 2 pi over n, with the delta t denominator, times k. So there are k states. These k states are the eigenstates of the matrix. And now you find that these eigenstates are equally spaced. So these are the eigenstates. Now we switch on quantum mechanics, or let's say we use quantum mechanics language. Quantum mechanics language is that this H is well known in quantum theory, it's called the Hamiltonian. And actually, the statement that the evolution operator is e to the minus I H delta T, that's the solution of the Schrödinger equation of the theory. And this Hamiltonian has some special property, namely all its eigenstates are equally spaced. Now, most of you will have had physics courses and have learned about the harmonic oscillator. The harmonic oscillator is exactly like this. It's a thing that has a Hamiltonian energy, and the states are equally spaced. That's very important, because when you make an operator that allows you to step from one level to the next level, that operator is sometimes called a creation operator, because it creates something. What does it create? Well, it creates energy. Well, in the real universe, we have elementary particles and composite particles and so on. We also work with creation operators, an operator which creates a particle out of nothing, just replaces the state by a different state. And you can apply such operators here too. So sometimes in the case of harmonic oscillator, we say that a particle is being created. But you can also go down and the particle is being annihilated. If you do both, you create the particle and you go back down again, you reach the same state as you had before. That's the mathematics of creation and annihilation operators, and it is extremely useful for doing physics. Because in doing physics, we like to describe the state which contains a certain number of particles. Well, we apply a creation operator here. We start with a vacuum state, we apply a creation operator here, another creation operator there, another one there, and then you have three particles, and then we ask what happens next. And so mathematically, it's very useful to do such a thing. Physically, it seems to describe the notion of elementary particles. So elementary particles are really one step upwards in the spectrum, and in one step downwards means that you removed the particle from the state. So this is the kind of mathematics that we want to do. And if you take now the same model I had before, just the ring of things that evolve stepwise, and you add this little body of mathematics to it, it becomes quantum mechanics. Because then the evolution thing says, well, you have to say that you have the Schrödinger equation, which is here. In the basis where H is diagonal, the Schrödinger equation looks very easy to solve. You can give it to any graduate student and you immediately solve it, undergraduate also. But we have done something strange. We have done a Fourier transformation of the ontological states. So now, is that allowed? Is that not crazy? Yes, it is very crazy from a physical point of view. But no, it's not crazy if you want to solve equations. So in this particular case, it's very hard to imagine that an equation would be too difficult to solve for something that just hops in circles like this. So if you ask, if I wait 100,000 years, where would it be? Well, then still that mathematics is not particularly hard. So, but you can imagine systems which are like this, but not just a single circle, but many different circles, or sometimes you don't know where a circle will end or something. So it's easy to imagine systems that are a lot more complicated. Here I have done the next step. The next step is I have a system which contains much more possible states. Here are all the states, and I have an evolution operator that says every state will, after one step, be in another state, and I pictured here this evolution operator by just writing a line between one state and the next. So this thing goes there, this thing goes there, this thing goes there, and so on. But if you sit in this circle, then, okay, after 8 steps, you're back. Here, after 3 steps, you're back. Here, after 11 steps or something like that, you are back. And you take now this whole system. It's a little bit more complicated than the previous system, but not very much. All you have to say is, okay, which of these, 1, 2, 3, 4, which of these 5 different circles am I in? If I know that, then I ask, okay, where am I going? I go from here to here. That's the evolution operator. It's not so much more difficult than the previous one. There's one little thing, the real universe. Well, in the real universe, you can ask, what does the real universe do? Well, you could imagine that the real universe contains states, which after a certain number of steps go back to themselves. These are never heard of, these states will never reach, but if you are in this state here, after 8 steps, you're back to where it was before. That's not a property of our universe. Our universe probably contains very many very, very long, or even infinite change, which never go back into themselves again. So the infinite chain is not so much more difficult to handle mathematically here than a finite chain. The Fourier transform becomes a continuous Fourier transform procedure, but otherwise the mathematics is nearly identical. You can still write down an operator, and now you have here 5 different possible series of eigenvalues of that operator. Again, the Hamiltonian. So here is a thing which was in 6 different states, so it hops from this state to that one, and so on, and after one period it goes back down. Here you have a state which hops between 8 states, and here between 3 states, and here between 11 states. And so we have these 5 systems. Oh yes, there's a 2 here, so it has only 2 possible states. So what you see, what you read off right away from this system, is that now we have particles with different energies. Here is a particle where the jump in energy has to be like this. Here the jump in energy is smaller. These particles are the lightest particles. They have very small energies. And now you can also see that this belongs to the long chain here. So the longer the chain, the lighter the particles are that you're describing, the energies of the particles. So this is something like the quantum mechanics of the system, containing particles of different kinds that you can describe in this universe. But now we can say, well, what I've done here is a little bit more than just writing down these so-called energy levels. I made a little transformation by starting not at the point at zero, but starting at the point delta E, where delta E is some finite energy. I am free to do that in quantum mechanical language. All you do is you just rotate those vectors in the complex plane. In quantum mechanics, rotating the complex plane is a very trivial procedure, so you're allowed to do that, but then the energy of the entire sequence will raise or will get lower. So I take these 5 different sequences and I move one of them up, one of them down, or choose any positions, and then I'll squeeze them all together. Now you get this energy spectrum. So what you see here is that if I have a system as it's still relatively simple here, if I have a system as simple as this, if I use this quantum mechanical technique of attaching vectors to all these states, I get an energy spectrum, which again, right away can become fairly complex looking. It isn't so complex, because if you look very carefully, you find this is just these 5 things squeezed together. But now you can see that by choosing the delta E's here, and by choosing sequences here with different lengths, you can get something that might look like a real quantum mechanical system. Any quantum mechanical system has a Hamiltonian, it has energy states, and if you know the energy eigenstate of the Hamiltonian, you can transform back from this to this picture. So if I encounter any quantum mechanical system, like an atomic nucleus or a black hole or anything that could be quantum mechanical, and I have identified its spectrum, I'll see if the spectrum can be disentangled this way, If so, then I know that this is the real model behind it. So I can reconstruct these pictures from carefully analyzing the spectrum. So now you see that perhaps when I encounter a quantum mechanical system, I can figure out what is lying behind it. And there's nothing weird about this. This is just a mathematical technique that doesn't go with observers or with pilot waves or all these things. So it is only mathematical procedure. So the message that I want to convey to you in this talk is that's all quantum mechanics is. It is a mathematical procedure of going from one set of vectors into another set of vectors. The vectors were there just for mathematical convenience, but rotating those vectors gives you the contact between these peculiar looking systems of operators with eigenvalues into something that you can all understand. This is just completely classical. There's no quantum mechanics in this picture at all. So that is the surprising thing. But now we can look at what is more likely the situation in our universe. And here comes a first sort of idea what our universe might possibly be. And the idea has been formulated many times by different physicists, philosophers, and others who think of the universe as one gigantic big machine. Machine contains little gears and wheels and levers all over the place in the entire universe, and the gears and levers of this machine do things that depend on what their neighbors are doing. So every single gadget in this great big automaton will proceed and make a step, do something, depending on what its neighbors are doing. They all look only at their neighbors, but the thing as a grand total will eventually become something very chaotic, because everybody is looking at his neighbors, but my neighbors are also looking at their neighbors, and their neighbors are looking at their neighbors. So if you wait a little amount of time, your system becomes gigantically complicated. But it is a member of the same set, particularly if the automaton can be reversed in time. That is to say, time runs vertically here. If you have the states here, and you can rediscover how it started in the past by running the automaton backwards, then you have exactly a thing that is represented by this picture. Although these blobs here, each of these blobs show one particular configuration in this automaton. So you can imagine our universe is tremendously big. The automaton which describes the universe will be tremendously complex. So yes, the universe is an example of such a mechanism, such a machinery, but of course it is extremely much more complicated. Just because it is so much complicated, tools which you might find clumsy to describe in the simple example I gave you before, now those tools might become extremely handy. And that is, I think, what's happening to our world, that our world looks quantum mechanical because the vector tool that I applied only to find some curious features of a simple model, this vector tool becomes the only existing tool that's powerful enough for us to analyze what's going on. Without quantum mechanics, we wouldn't be able to understand how our world is functioning. So this is the underlying theory of quantum mechanics. Basically, therefore, the quantum world is extremely simple, but it gets complicated just because there are so many ingredients in there. So the cellular automaton, this is called a cellular automaton because these things before are called cells, and every cell reacts upon, only looks at its neighbor to see what happens. And now we can do the same trick as I did before. Now it becomes a very complicated trick, but figure out all the periodic movements of this automaton and figure out what the eigenvalues of these different modes then will be, and figure out whether the spectrum of possible energy states we get, whether that spectrum in any way looks like the spectrum we see in the real universe. This becomes an interesting mathematical exercise. We can look at this idea in two different ways. The cellular automaton theory is the theory that our universe indeed is a machine like this. It doesn't really look like one very much because there's empty space. What do we have in empty space? Well, according to this idea, even empty space is full of gears and levers which somehow do a job, but in empty space, they realize situation with the lowest energy. So the vacuum state is not an eigenstate of this machine, it's an eigenstate after we made this discrete Fourier transformation. So even the vacuum state is extremely complex. Then I can add a particle, and adding a particle goes exactly like what I said here in the simple model. Yeah, I go from one energy level to the next, I create energy. A particle is a representative of energy. So big, heavy particles require lots of energy to be created. Light particles require very little energy to be created. But particles can also move. And then the mass or mass energy of a particle when it moves is controlled by Einstein's equations. But okay, all these particles are described by equally spaced energy levels. And all we have to do is assume that when we try to study a quantum process of the universe, take in your mind that actually this quantum process is just because we are thinking in terms of quantum mechanical states, but we really should be thinking about these deterministic systems that just hop from one state to the next state, like an automaton, where eventually in those terminologies, in this last terminology, quantum mechanics is not needed, Hilbert space is not needed, vectors, observers are all not needed. All you have to understand is how states evolve. But the theory then is that there is such an automaton which represents our present universe. The cellular automaton interpretation is that you say, well, this exists, but I'm not going to try to find out what it is. I'll just assume that this is the way things work. And then I can ask, you know, when I do a quantum experiment or when I try to set up a theory that has quantum mechanics at its basis, what, how can I understand what I'm seeing? And how can I understand all these apparent mysteries that quantum mechanics has produced? I'm sure that there have been many talks here about quantum mysteries, about what you can do with quantum mechanics that is impossible to understand classically. Fundamentally impossible. And now I'm just again obnoxious and say, okay, people say it's fundamentally impossible. I don't believe that. I think this idea I just sketched is too pretty to be false. And I say, no, we are used to working with these vectors so much in elementary particle physics, in theoretical physics in general, even solid state physics and all these subdomains of physics. Where we use quantum mechanics. And when you only use quantum mechanics, you only make this notation of Hilbert space and vectors, and you never ask what is it that's really going on when I do an experiment, then you find yourself every now and then to be confronted with complete mysteries. So I'm trying to explain with this theory where these mysteries come from. So the cellular automaton interpretations. Let's assume that when I look at this universe or I look at a part of it, I'm looking at one particular kind of particle or one particular kind of interaction between one particular kind of particles. And I'm asking myself, how can I understand what I'm seeing? Well, the thing is, try to do this Fourier transformation, as I talked about, backwards. So find the ontological states if you know what the states are that you were normally looking at when you describe a hydrogen atom or an atomic nucleus or even a star or a planet. Then what we want to do first is find out what those fundamental states were which are hopping from one value to another value. If you have those states, you can now describe operators that tell you in what particular state you are. Those operators are operators which all commute. Commutation means that if you apply an operator in two different orders, you first do this and then that, you get something else, and if you first do this and then that. So operators often have an effect that depends on their order. If so, you have to understand that. You have to understand how these operators act on what I call the ontological states of the universe to figure out why their action depends on their order. Or some operators are not changing the state at all, but just naming the states, like how much is the energy of this state, or where is that particle sitting without moving at all. And then if I have such operators, they should all commute. So a beable is an operator that commutes with all the other beables. It commutes because it's so simple and it acts in this ontological world where I want to understand my universe. So I must define operators that all commute at all times. Now the X operator in quantum mechanics commutes with X operators of other particles in quantum mechanics, or other components of this X operator all commute, but it does not commute with momentum. Nevertheless, sometimes you can think that momentum is also a fundamental property of a state in the universe. So you are a little bit confused and at a loss. What are the true beables when I'm looking at a particle or at a bunch of particles or anything else? So the first thing is identify those beables. This is a very hard mathematical question because so few people are asking it. And I think if we get more experience, we'll be able to have more clever techniques mathematically to figure out a possible candidate for a set of beables. My candidate might be the wrong candidate, by the way. There could be very many different choices of beables, and it's not obvious that we find the right operators right from the first start. Maybe we have to make many models, but this would be a good start to understand what is really happening in this universe. Anyway, this is just the operation of rotating vectors. So Hilbert space, the space that we work with when we do quantum mechanics, consists of vectors with millions and millions of different components. So rotating such vectors is a hell of a job. But when you do that correctly, you might find that if you make the right rotation, you'll find the set of beables. You'll call that the ontological basis. So the ontological basis is the basis where my vectors are just like in my first slide. In this slide, each vector just represents a state of the thing that I'm in. But as easy as it looks here, so difficult it is in systems as complex as anything like our universe. So the cellular automaton interpretation assumes that such a basis exists. Even if you don't, if you're unable to identify it, you can understand why things are happening the way they are, because the basis should exist. And now the next thing is that in a given quantum system, we have to devise strategies to figure out in what basis we can be sitting. And as I said, those strategies have not yet been developed very well. Every now and then, I'm trying to do something and I hit rather unexpectedly on interesting models where I know what to do now to get this. You could call this theory a hidden variable theory, just like the ones that Bell said he could disprove. And so now, of course, I'm getting into a difficulty with Bell. He was a good friend of mine, so why should I fight against him? Well, I just have some disagreements about things that he assumes as being obvious. Now, I'll introduce some notions. And one notion is the notion of a template state. When we describe an atom, say the hydrogen atom is a well-known example because it is sufficiently simple for students to solve the equations or to understand the solution of the equations that they read in a book. And and once you solve the equations, you can understand how to compute anything with a hydrogen atom. But the question is, then you get the quantum states, and when you look at the quantum numbers of the hydrogen atom and other things, they are not beables, because when two hydrogen atoms collide, things happen that are way more complicated than when it would have been description in terms of beables. So what would be the beables of the hydrogen atom? And so what you have to do is you have to perform a transformation to find the beables. That transformation is a rotation, and your job is then find that rotation. You could also decide not to do it directly because it's too hard, But then you, again, you can look at that Schrödinger equation. Now remember, I had here, in the previous graph here, I had this Hamiltonian sitting here, and this is a Schrödinger equation. I can apply this operator to a vector. I can apply it to any of these, and then tells me where to sit next. But if I apply the same operator to a superposition of these vectors, the same operator tells you how the thing evolves in time. If I take a superposition, after one time step, again you'll have a superposition, but the superposition coefficients have not changed. This sounds somewhat strange for people who know quantum mechanics. They say, well, when you evolve a system in time, surely the superposition coefficients will change like that. That's because they're looking at these coefficients in the wrong basis. If they would use the ontological basis, they would find, much to their surprise perhaps, that the superposition coefficients don't change in time. So, but if they do change in time, you know you're not working with an ontological state, you're working with a template. And a template is a complicated superposition of many different possible states the universe can be in. And that's legal, you can take such a state, it obeys the same Schrödinger equation. In other words, if I know the Hamiltonian for those states, I know enough. If I know the spectrum, I can possibly find back the ontological states. So the idea is I have templates, I have ontological states, the ontological states are superposition of the templates. The templates are equally well superpositions of the ontological states. These coefficients alpha together form a matrix. These coefficients lambda form a matrix. Both are unitary matrices, and the matrix generated by the alphas is the inverse of the matrices generated by the lambdas. So, and then we can do something that people also thought very mysterious, but here it's quite logical to do. You take the absolute value square of lambdas and you say that number, if I normalize that number to 1, then my states are always normalized to 1. What could these coefficients mean? Well, they mean nothing at all. They just mean I'm doing mathematics. That's all they mean. But since I have these things available, I can take a superposition of ontic states. Some coefficients lambda will be bigger than others. What could that mean? Well, let's give it a probabilistic interpretation. We are totally free to do that. It's not a law of physics that this is a probability. No, it's our choice to say, okay, let's have lambda squared be a probability. It works very well. The probabilities are conserved. The total probability of a state being anywhere is then 1. If it is 1 for once, it's 1 forever. Probabilities also transform the same way when you have the evolution of the system. So it makes a lot of sense to say that lambda absolute square is a probability. But you don't have to say it. The only thing is, if you go to more complicated calculations, it is extremely useful to interpret lambda squared as a probability. It is an interpretation. If you don't like the interpretation, choose lambda to the third. Choose 1 over lambda. I don't care what it is. But you will find that your calculation become a lot more difficult. So take the easiest thing, where lambda absolute square is the probability. This is very important, because this would later become a complicated discussion in quantum mechanics. Why is it that these coefficients squared are probabilities? We didn't say they were. My answer to that is yes, you did. But you didn't know it. You're working with templates. You didn't know it. The coefficients of the templates have only one reasonable interpretation as a probability. But you didn't know that. And that's why you're now caught by surprise. But really, it's a quite logical thing to do. And if you choose that to be part of the cellular automaton interpretation of quantum mechanics, it will stay like that. So what we're really doing is we are rotating these templates. And that's how we use a template. It's just a rotation of the ontological states. So the beables are in one particular basis of states. The beables, other basis of states, then the same state looks like a template. So now about classical and quantum. So in quantum mechanics, people often come with the following problem, that they start with a quantum system, they see something happening, they have a detector, and the detector then says click or doesn't say click. And finally, they have a quantum registration of what they saw, and that registration starts to behave totally classically. It would take two physical review papers, even the time that they were written in physical review, and I interchange those papers. Of course, it's all classical logic to which these papers are applied, obeying. While the contents may be a quantum mechanical article, but those the things found in the article then start to behave totally classically. So when you measure something, a quantum system can turn into a classical system. And I like to think now of what a classical system really is within this theory. So suppose that the universe is this big cellular automaton. What does it mean for a cellular automaton to be in a classical state? Actually, the answer to that is not so hard. Think of a planet. And I think a planet as a prototype of something classical. A planet also obeys a Schrödinger equation, but it is ridiculous to subject an entire planet to a single Schrödinger equation. It doesn't help you any. So the planet is an object of which I can identify the location without any doubt, without having the need to apply quantum mechanics at all. So a planet is classical. Now, take a cubic millimeter of the material out of which the planet is being formed. Deep inside the planet, I carve out a cubic millimeter and I ask myself the following question. Can I see the difference between the matter the planet is made of and the vacuum state? So a cellular automaton in the vacuum could at some moment fluctuate in such a way that it describes the vacuum. At another moment, it fluctuates in such a way that describes matter inside the planet. Would I be able, by just looking at the automaton, to see whether it is part of a planet or whether it's a vacuum? I would find it hard to believe that you would not be able to. So if you just say, well, maybe statistically this thing is more often green here than there, then when it's more often green, I'll call it a planet. If it doesn't turn green very often, I call it a vacuum state. Or I've done this out of experience. So I've analyzed the vacuum state in terms of the cellular automaton. I found that some positions are more frequent than others. That's the vacuum state. And inside the planet, I find some distribution to be slightly different than I'm inside the planet. As soon as you say that, you can say, well, for one cubic millimeter, I can sort of figure out that this is probably inside the planet and this is probably outside. But a planet consists of billions of cubic millimeters. So if for every cubic millimeter in turn I can say that I'm inside the planet, I'm getting more and more certainty that actually I have this planet right here. What I want to say with this argument is that the position of a planet is identifiable by looking at the state of a cellular automaton. If that holds for a planet, it probably holds for everything that's classical. It holds for me walking around and giving this talk, it holds for a fly when it flies in the air. It may also hold for the outcome of an experiment when the outcome becomes visible on the dial of a machine or as a trace of bubbles in the bubble chamber or something like that. Then it becomes classical. In other words, there are ontic states and there are classical states. The classical state is identifiable inside the world of ontological states. So that means that the classical states themselves are also ontological. In other words, the planet there is really there because we have been able to, for certainty, to decide that was the planet. What does certainty mean? Well, it's if I had chance one out of a thousand that I misidentify in the cubic millimeter, but I have a billion cubic millimeters, then the odds that I'm making a mistake is 1 over 1,000 raised to a power of a billion. Those numbers are much more accurate than any numbers that we normally encounter in physics. So it becomes certain that we have a classical state. So the difference between classical states and quantum states is only that for the classical states, we have been able to identify when it is ontological and when not. I can still superimpose two planets if I want to, but these superimposed things describe a cellular automaton in a state which is physically impossible. That's not a template, not an ontological state of the cellular automaton. So when you ask, you argue this way, you can find that I can understand what it means for a state to be classical. It is a state that I can identify in my automaton. Whereas if I take a single atom, the atom can be in a wave, and the atom can be here or there, described by the, a wave function a la Bohm and Du Bois and so on. So if I have a wave, then the atom itself is not an ontological state. So this is just a very easy way to do away with a problem that some philosophers in particular have with quantum mechanics. All classical states are ontological states. And now it comes to the question of measurement. So I also hear very often that quantum physicists have some difficulties understanding what he's doing when he's making a measurement. Because what is it? It is something very crazy. Think of a particle physics experiment. Two particles come here and they scatter. And they can scatter in this way, they can scatter that way, they can scatter that way. They can scatter in all sorts of ways. And the outcome of the calculation is typically a quantum wave function. And now we say it's a quantum wave function, so now if I do a measurement, the outcome of the experiment will also be a quantum wave function. So if the particle has two possibilities of having an outcome which are superimposed as a quantum state, so there's a superposition between this answer and that answer, then there's also a superposition between the two answers of the measuring devices, either this or that, but it looks like a superposition. And the question that's often been asked, does that mean that the measuring device itself is in a superposition? The answer is no, I just decided the measuring apparatus is classical. So I know it's not in a superposition, and that is because in this case I know it's in an ontic state, and I am free to choose on the superposition of the ontic states. But if I ask myself what's really happening, it's probability such that it is here and probability so that it's there. It's our probabilities and never really superpositions. And the lambda squared, and now remember something very elementary that I mentioned earlier. These superposition coefficients, lambda, are conserved in time as long as you talk about ontological things. So if you have an initial state which was a superposition of ontological states, the outcome will similarly be superpositions. The converse also holds. If the outcome is a superposition of states, it means that my starting signal was not, my starting state was not a pure ontic state, it was a template. And now, since most quantum experiments all give superpositions as outcome, now I know that all templates I'm using to write down the initial state of an experiment, they're all really templates. None of them is a truly ontological state. It only is if the outcome never leaves any room for uncertainties, probabilistic uncertainties. In practice, they often do, and they give quantum superpositions. So that way I know that those beams of particles are not ontological particles at all. They are all superpositions of many possible states of the automaton. And this is, to me, a much more satisfactory answer than saying that these particles were guided by waves. It is just that they were represented by vectors, but those vectors are describing superpositions, and the superpositions describe probabilities. And this is how quantum mechanics can be worked to can be made to work very, very well without me explicitly knowing what the templates are and what the ontological states are, because that's a very, very difficult mathematical question. In other words, the ontological states are all orthonormal particles. Superpositions of ontological states are never ontological states themselves. They are all, the universe, however, on the other hand, is an ontological state. Something similar about the collapse of the wave function. Again, here, I think many people who study quantum mechanics make very outrageous remarks about what they call the collapse of the wave function. What happens when you do an experiment, a quantum experiment, you have either this state or that state, or a superposition of the state. And the calculation often says you have a superposition. And now we say, no, but the outcome is not a superposition. The outcome is probabilities. There's a probability that this is the outcome, or a probability that that's the outcome. Now, when did the wave function change from a superimposed wave function, a superimposed state, to a state where there are probabilities? How did that happen? And it is thought that this was a physical process for which you have to modify the Schrödinger equation. I'm not modifying the Schrödinger equation at all. But I'm saying that the outcome of the experiment cannot be a superposition, not if you look in terms of the original ontological states of the universe. It will always be a probability. And the probabilities are there because I was ignorant about the initial state I started off with. That is why the wave function seems to collapse, whereas in reality, only my understanding is improving. I now know by probability something that it's here, the other probability is that it's there. There could be thousands of different probable answers of a quantum experiment, but I know those probabilities are not a physical phenomenon. They are caused by our description of the initial state as a template rather than an ontological state. And so this is now how the whole picture of quantum mechanics can become a lot more understandable. In fact, even Schrödinger, one of the founding fathers of quantum mechanics, very important, who found as the first one the correct equation for the evolution of particles, he said what is being said about my equation is nonsense, because imagine that I do an experiment but also put a cat in a box. And I think all of you know the Schrödinger cat experiment, so I don't have to really repeat it here. But the cat seems to come out, when you have a quantum experiment here, the cat seems to emerge in a superposition of dead and alive. And that is because by one outcome of the experiment, the box of poison was being opened. By another outcome of the experiment, the poison stayed closed. So the cat dies with one outcome of the experiment and lives on with another outcome of the experiment. Suppose the experiment is designed such that chances were 50-50. Then you can ask, if I open the box, do I see the cat in a superposition or not? And the answer is, of course not, because the cat is a classical system, and classical systems all evolve entirely over in ontological ways. So the cat is either dead or alive and never in a superposition. But you have to understand how quantum mechanics works in order to be able to make such a statement. So the cellular automaton interpretation simplifies reasoning a lot. The only difficulty is that we are left over with today. It is so hard to identify the correct basis of ontological states. But we have to understand that what we are really looking at is our universe with billions and billions of degrees of freedom, but we are only looking at the universe being in one ontological state of the cellular automaton. Actually, what the detailed rules are of this automaton is still way beyond our ability to figure out. I'm optimistic. I think humanity might find a good way to do that. Just let me show another Gedanken experiment to bring home the argument. The planetary system is a system that's classical, sort of a prototype of classical systems. Forget that you might not know exactly where a planet is, and the planet might make some oscillations. In fact, quantum oscillations of the planet will eventually force upon us some uncertainty about where the planet will be later. But for all practical purposes, you can consider the planetary system as a classical system. So consider just how the planets move in 100 years or something, or 1,000 years. Everything is completely classical. Now I'm going to use the quantum language for these planets. I'm going to introduce an operator. And this is one of my favorite operators in the planetary system, is the Earth-Mars interchange operator. I take planet Earth, put it where Mars is. I take Mars, put it where Earth is now. That's my operator. And now I turn up the books about quantum mechanics to ask what does quantum mechanics say about this operator. It says two things. It says the square of the operator is one, because if I do this twice, I get Mars where Earth was, where Mars was in the first place, and Earth gets back to where it was also. So applying this operator twice gives me the identity operator. In other words, the operator square is one, and so the operator has two eigenvalues, plus one or minus one. So my question is, suppose I measure this operator, do I get plus one or minus one? And then I read from Copenhagen that, yes, you should be able to measure the particle. The operator is a unitary operator, it's also a Hermitian operator. Hermitian operators are observable, they say. So yes, if you design the right detection machine, you can figure out whether the operator is plus one or minus one. But how do I do that? I can't really interchange Earth and Mars. Even NASA, I don't think at present, can do that. So So is it operator plus one or minus one? Actually, the correct answer is the operator is not a counterfactual, is not a factual operator. It's a counterfactual operator. It's an operator that you could only measure if you wouldn't know where Earth and Mars actually are. Think of exoplanets very far away and you don't know yet which is which because it's too far away. Then you still imagine interchanging those operators and applying quantum techniques to figure out what the true position of these, operators, of these planets are. But for Earth and Mars, it's unthinkable that you can measure this operator because we know the ontological coordinates of Earth and Mars. And because we are so certain that this is Earth and we're not sitting on Mars, all of us together, that we know this so certainly that we don't have to ask the question about what would happen if Earth and Mars were interchanged and to what extent does it coincide with our state now. It doesn't. So this is an operator that you cannot measure, in spite of what Copenhagen says. So this is how such questions can now be answered without running into endless discussions, because it's all clear what we are doing. Now I have a couple of models where I was able to identify the variables to some extent. And I mentioned three prototypes. There's more, there's also the harmonic oscillator. It's a very trivial one. But as if you take one massless particle in one space, one time dimension, in that case, it's not so hard to identify the variables because such a particle will move at the speed of light in one direction or the other direction. And it never changes direction as long as it is massless and doesn't interact with anybody else. It just continues to move to the right or continue to move to the left forever. And it goes at a fixed velocity. So if I have the particle here, and I know it's a right moving particle, I know for sure it will be there and it will be a right moving particle after a certain amount of time. I know exactly where it will be because it will always go with the same velocity. So this is a system where it's very easy to identify the ontological operators. There's another example that I'll briefly explain in the next slide, non-relativistic particles. That's a lot harder because non-relativistic particles have a variable velocity. In fact, their velocity depends on their momentum. But momentum does not commute with position. So you cannot localize the position and the momentum at the same time. This is a lot harder to identify the variables. But I think I could identify the variables for this system as well, provided that the particle lives in two space dimensions. Then it becomes relatively easy to do. Another example is massless particles in higher dimensions, in particular in 3 plus 1, because then they look like neutrinos. But again, because they are massless, they go with a fixed velocity. And I can say something with certainty when I have the particle here now, that where it will be a moment later, if I also know the spin of the particle. So this is a typical example where I could identify the variables. The third example is interesting because it's so non-trivial. It's in fact, this third example is extremely non-trivial, but the transformation from the familiar template states and the ontic states which I could derive is a very complicated transformation. And that's very typical in these models, that the transformation, the actual act to go from one system to the other system, is complicated and requires a lot of calculations. But here it's a very interesting exercise. It took me a while to get everything straight because it's so difficult. It's a neutrino, it's a spin 1/2 particle I'm talking about. And for a spin 1/2 particle, which is massless, this can be done. So in the case of the massless particle in one space, one time, the position operators at all times always commute, so that I know for sure that this position for a right moving and for a left moving particle are ontological variables. The velocity is plus or minus one. This is the example of a particle in two space, one time dimension. Two space, one time, because now if I put the system in a finite box, the momenta are discrete. And because the momenta are discrete, I can count the states in momentum space. And now I say, let's consider all states where the momentum is bounded by a value lambda. How many states do I have? And you can say, okay, that's roughly the surface of this circle. So the momenta in the x direction and y direction are all bounded, but the total momentum is bounded by the circle. The total circle is pi times the radius of the circle. That's the number of states I have in here. So the total number of states is pi times lambda squared times the length of these of the box times 4 pi squared. So horizontally and vertically, these things are slightly different spaced. The total energy is also lambda squared, because the energy of the rim is bounded by lambda. So the number of states increases linearly with energy. That means they're equally spaced. Now, they're not exactly equally spaced. There are some small fluctuations, but that you can attribute to the fact that you have a box with a boundary. If the box is a little bit more complicated, then the levels will be slightly different range. In other words, these minute fluctuations that you get in the energy of particles, making them deviate from linearity is negligible. And that's why this is a linearly spaced set of particles. I had solved that problem. I just take these energy eigenstates and I say that the ontological variable is just the discrete Fourier transform of these states. An even nicer example is if I take particles not sitting in a box, but sitting on a two-dimensional sphere. So 2 plus 1, a sphere living in 3 dimensions with a 2-dimensional surface. I have the particles living on the surface. Then the operators for the particle is not position and momentum, but position and angular momentum. So I have the L1 and the L2, and my Hamiltonian is L squared, which is just a kinetic term, and I give it a little magnetic field to sort of get an L3 term as well. L3 linear means that there's a weak magnetic field which couples to the particle such that if they rotate one way, the energy is slightly higher than rotating the other way. Then the energy levels are given by L times L plus 1, that's the eigenstates of L squared, and L3, which has the eigenstates M, where this number M is can take the number of values in which the L state can split. And set of levels is very interesting. The levels, in this case, total angular momentum goes quadratically, so L plus 1 is 0 here, 1, 2, 4, 8, and so on. The L plus 1 goes quadratically, but the splitting goes linearly, and this L is non-degenerate. This L splits in 3 values, this L splits in 5 values, this one goes to 7, 9, and so on. And now you see that just by accident, by choosing magnetic field here of the appropriate strength, these are perfectly linearly evenly separated energy levels. And now I can say, oh, but now I can identify this as an ontological system, because this is exactly the spectrum of states for a system going over one circle only. So the ontological state is the quantity alpha, which I get by Fourier transforming this LM state. And then alpha is the variable I'm looking for, because that alpha just moves around. The whole thing goes over a circle with this many states. Only thing is, I do need a cutoff. I do need to stop somewhere. If it didn't stop somewhere, then this alpha would not be a discretized variable. It would be a continuous thing, just moving around a circle like this. But that limit looks very easy. It's somewhat treacherous. The model is not quite as easy as you might think. But you see that I get back basically the same system. And by only looking at the Hamiltonian, I can identify the eigenstates of the Hamiltonian. I can make all transformations I want. So I can redefine all operators for this particle and say they're all ontological. So this is an ontological model in disguise. You might have thought that this was a particle living on the surface of a sphere, but not so. The particle actually is an ontological thing moving in circles. And the automaton, my time is sort of over, I think. The automaton is a system that you can also apply if the automaton steps are taken in 2 steps. The one step is that the yellow boxes, which are sitting at the outside, the yellow boxes respond to what the neighbors are doing. The neighbors are sitting still, but the yellow box just makes a change depending on what, and the kind of change it makes depends on the contents of its neighbors. That holds for all yellow boxes. When I'm done with all the yellow boxes, I take all the red boxes and they're not really colored red there, but they're colored red, pink there. The pink boxes change after that, and that change depends only in what the yellow boxes are doing. This is a time reversible procedure, and so this is a perfect example where I can apply my techniques, but I can also apply more advanced quantum mechanics and the so-called Baker-Campbell-Hausdorff formula. Because if I make only the shifts of the yellow boxes, then those are very easy to compute, and it's very easy to identify the operators A and B that are sitting here in the exponent. So operators A, they modify the yellow boxes, the operator B modifies the pink boxes, and if I take the product of these two operators, I get the entire operator that gives you one step of the celular automaton. My question had been how to find the appropriate Hamiltonian doing that. Well, that's a well-known mathematical problem. If you have the product of two exponents or operators, you can write that as another operator, which is e to the power c. So u is e to the minus I h now, I hit this h. I want to compute h knowing a and b. And the answer is, to some approximation, h is just a sum of a and b. But then there are correction terms. The first correction term is the commutator between a and b, then it becomes the commutator meter with the commutator, and on it goes. And this series is known with an enormous large number of terms in mathematical literature. So it means in this system, I can calculate the h by a perturbative technique. I'm using a perturbation expansion. That's very interesting because lots of physics is done by perturbative techniques. All of quantum field theory, where I describe elementary particles, hinges on our ability to do perturbation expansions. So this is as yet another perturbation expansion. This looks very much like what we are doing in quantum field theory. And so this could be a way to generate some quantum field theory by trying all cellular automata, figuring out all possible matrices A and B, and finding out what the rules are if you combine them together. And this mathematics is not so very well known. It's not really in the standard toolbox of physicists, although we sometimes apply operations like this. It's not yet very well developed. So this is why this is still hard in practice. But in principle, it could be done in a very fundamental way, and we could try to study all sorts of different cellular automata and see where they bring us, where they get. You can get anything looking like the standard model of the elementary particles. And now Mr. Bell, who said it's all wrong. Not only Bell says that, I every now and then I put something on the internet and then I get this whole avalanche of reactions where people say, you're completely wrong, it cannot be true. Well, what was wrong so far about what I was saying? Maybe I was taking an outrageous position in quantum mechanics, but it doesn't seem to be wrong, not yet. But then Bell basically says the following thing. If Bob and Alice measure two entangled particles. So what this is there's a source here emitting two photons. The photons are entangled. That's essential in Bell's Gedanken experiment. It goes back to Einstein, Rosen, and Podolsky, who formulated a similar thing to prove that quantum mechanics cannot be produced by, that quantum mechanics somehow is basically wrong, it's not physics. This photon can come out in two helicities, and these helicities are entangled. Then Bob and Alice both measure their helicities, and then later they compare their data. And I'm not going through all the details about how to prove that the outcome of these experiments gives something that cannot ever be modeled by classical photons at all. But I'll just say what the claim was of the outcome. The outcome was, if Bob or Alice or both make a small change in their settings, they measure something else in these photons. And that's where you get the contradictions. When Bob decides to change something in the setting, Alice keeps the same setting as she had before. Her photon will not have changed, but Bob's photon will look a bit different because Bob changed something in his settings. And now you can ask, how can this ever be reproduced by a classical answer? And the answer is you can't do it. That's simple. And the reason is that this photon, both photons came in some sort of polarization state, and now if either Bob or Alice or both make a change, then the outcome should be something else. Now you can just ask, does this work in the classical description? You can look it up, and you may have heard talks before about this. There was another talk here just only a few days ago about problems of this kind. This is a well-known experiment by now. So this is you can ask now the correlations. You find that these photons are actually correlated not with the things that Bob and Alice are measuring, but the settings they choose for their detectors. Now, how can Bob and Alice choose settings before they measure the photon that nevertheless can be influenced by the photon here? That sounds fundamentally impossible. Because of that, they say, no way. This is hidden variable theory, forget it. But these photons come out in ontological states, because the entire universe is ontological, so all Alice and Bob do is always ontological. They can never do anything in superposition. Whereas they are assuming they can do something such that this photon, which was ontological before when Bob was measuring it, after Bob changes his setting, this photon goes into quantum superposition. And now the theory that I'm proposing here says that's not allowed. This photon can't come in a quantum superposition. These two photons, just because either Bob or Alice choose their position differently, these two photons become two different photons. And ha ha ha, they shout on the internet. How can that be? How can these photons know what Bob and Alice are going to do? Bob and Alice have free will. Now I ask, yeah, but no, they don't have exactly free will. Their actions themselves are also determined by the past. And then they come and they say, yeah, but suppose that Alice has her decision depend on a quasar she looks at here, a billion light years away. Bob looks at another quasar, a billion light years away, and they now look at the photons, and these photons oscillate a little bit, and depending on those photons, they choose a setting. How can these photons here be correlated with these quasars? Well, I computed, and indeed I found that there is a correlation. It's an absolute function of the sign. This is the minimum amount of correlation you need in a hidden variable model. So yes, there's correlations. Isn't that strange? It's very strange, unless you say that even at this stage, when you have the source here, the quasar here, and the quasar here, they should be in an ontological state. The entire universe should be in an ontological state. Therefore, these photons, whether they like it or not, will be in an ontological state. And Bob and Alice will also be in an ontological state to measure those photons. If Bob would rotate his device, he would be sensitive to photons which are not in the ontological state. That's not allowed. So Bob can't rotate his machine without affecting these photons. That's actually causality backwards in time. And that's why I get a big laugh on the internet. They say, that's impossible. How can Bob's action modify these photons? But that's the essence of this idea, that not only the photons, also those observers, Bob and Alice, are controlled by laws of nature. They are part of the great big cellular automaton, whether they like it or not. But this is a very peculiar situation. And I explain basically the things here, that if you make a small change, L is a setting that, for instance, chosen by Bob or by Alice, and L plus delta L is a slightly different Alice. But then all these classical states here are totally different classical states. So even a minute change of a setting that Bob and Alice chose causes a change that is macroscopic, that's classical. So that classical change has a big effect on the automaton. And so since so many elements of the automaton are now in a different state than they were before, it means that way down to the past, the whole universe must have been in a different state as well. And this is something one really has to get used to. I'll skip this argument. There is a law, I think the magic word here is a law of ontology conservation. These cellular automaton, these things that just hop from one to the next, when you have an ontological state here, it can only hop into ontological states. A object that follows the classical law of nature can never hop from an ontological state into a quantum superposition. Such models were never even thought of by quantum physicists, which is why they run into these apparent contradictions. It's not allowed for a system to evolve into a superposition of other states if it wasn't a superposition itself as well. Not if you turn, if you talk about ontological states. So this is the idea that we have to get used to, and this changes our view of what quantum mechanics is. I think I'm myself that this is a logical way to think about quantum mechanics. Try to keep the fundamental laws of nature as simple as possible. That's why I liked the name of this meeting. It's about simplicity, not about complexity. Complexity is only too confusing, and we make mistakes all the time. But simplicity is harder. It's still possible to make mistakes in simplicity, but it's harder. So that's why I believe this is a correct path. So as for the non-observable hidden variables, they are very difficult to find, but just let's try to calculate and see what happens. And open our mouth after we found calculations that work. And maybe this helps to identify the laws on which the standard model should be based. And so this is an important motivation for this study, is we want to understand physics at the tiniest possible distance scale. Maybe we are living on a giant cellular automaton. I should stop here because maybe there are questions, and I would like to go into a discussion if still possible. Thank you.
We should start our questions from students. Are there any student questions?
Yes, I should. I thought there should be questions, yes?
Can you?
Hey, so this might be like a very fundamental misunderstanding or like a really shallow notational problem.
Sorry, so I have still some difficulties hearing you. Somehow.
Okay, I'll speak up.
Acoustics here is not so good.
Is this better?
Yes, okay.
Or can you just hear me like this?
Yes, it's all right.
I'm just gonna do this. So, when I take a ontological state, but I'm not allowed to do addition with it, because when you add those things, they're what you call prepositions. Like,
right.
What good is it as a vector? It doesn't seem like it's not a good state in any way if I'm not allowed to do addition.
The only thing you're not allowed to is make superpositions and draw the wrong conclusions. But you are allowed to make superpositions if you tell them from that moment on, the superposition coefficients are to be interpreted as probabilities. Then you're allowed to make a superposition.
I guess what
now,
I mean
now, if you take ontological states, that's exactly the rule. If you take templates, you're also allowed to make superpositions of templates. What it really means is you end up with different superpositions of the ontological states. The question often asked is, I have an experiment, I'm using templates all the time, I have this outcome, what is the probability of having this template? What's the probability of having that template? That question is a wrong question, but is usually not needed to ask, because the outcome will never be a template. The outcome of the experiment will be an ontological state. Certainly, as soon as you made it classical, you have the measurement apparatus measuring the classical result. That apparatus is in an ontological state. So the outcome of the experiment is ontological. But if you ask the wrong question, you'll get the wrong answer. And the wrong question is, what's the probability that this is a template such and such, or that's a template so and so? That question is, strictly speaking, illegal. You get the outcome which by itself is interesting, because a template could be an ontological state, and then the answer is correct.
But it sounds like, I mean, these ontological states don't really obey properties of linear states. It doesn't sound like they're the same thing as these template states or these
Well,
states.
I claim it is the same thing, nevertheless.
But I'm not allowed to add them anyway.
Sorry?
But I'm not allowed to add them. I can't do addition with them.
So we start with ontological states. You can never get another ontological state by superimposing ontological states. That is impossible. But you can get another template by superimposing other templates. So by superimposing templates, you can get any template you like. And you can do superposition as much as you like, provided that you realize that you're working with templates. But you should also realize that when you do an experiment, the outcome of the experiment as a position on a dial or a photographic plate which is darkened, that is classical. That's not a template, that's ontological. You cannot superimpose pictures of outcomes of experiments. That is forbidden. But you can superimpose the templates with which you started, even though in many experiments people thought we know exactly what the particles are in the initial state. At CERN, they focus their beams, know exactly how much their beams are focused, this and that, and so they know exactly their initial state, and then they found the outcome to be bunch of templates. But they don't know the states well enough. They don't know only that the protons went through this circle, but they don't know where they went through the circle, nor do they know exactly by which momentum. They know it approximately within a certain window. But in reality, there's so enormous uncertainties about the exact positions of all the inside ingoing particles. They know that because they know many protons will miss. Every now and then they'll hit each other. They never know exactly what the impact parameter of the proton will be ahead of time. They can reconstruct afterwards what likely the impact parameter of these protons has been. But you start with uncertainties. These protons, when they started to come to each other, they were in a template state. They were in a superposition of all the transverse positions in order for them to have the momentum, was well oriented to hit each other in that direction. So the initial states were also templates. And that's why the final states look like templates, but then you find out what way they are superpositions of the ontological states. We haven't done that mathematics because it's very, very difficult. So it's still completely open how to do this. The only thing you have to realize is that those are ontological states I end up with. But if you look at this carefully enough, you find there's no contradiction in the statement itself. You might question whether this is a true model of nature. That's, you know, that freedom you have.
So I guess the idea is then that your ontological states aren't really vectors, but the templates are, and that the fact that you describe ontological states as vectors is because it's just like a consequence of how we want to describe the system. Because if you have a ontological state and you can't add two ontological states to make a third, then the ontological states aren't vectors in a vector space. Rather, the description of the ontological states using templates is where we get the actual like idea of a vector from.
So you are certainly allowed to superimpose ontological states. In the world of the templates, there's nothing strange about that superposition, but you should not think that that's ontological anymore. Mm-hmm. From that moment on, you are using a template, which is fine, which is what we do all the time. So in reality, we don't even know what the ontological states are.
Yeah.
So the only thing we have today is the templates.
So my...
And they work so well that we don't even often ask the question what they mean.
My proper question is then, if you do a bunch of experiments to find out, like, I guess what your first example was, this giant energy spectrum of your system, then I guess is the goal just to like construct these ontological states from the energy spectrum by some crazy optimization problem?
I missed something of your last sentence.
So you have all this data from like the energy spectrum and you want to convert it back into the energy spectrums of the individual like ontological processes?
Yes.
So I'm guessing has anybody imagined any actual way to do this backpropagation where you find out the ontological states?
The way will be to find sequences of spectral lines which are equally spaced. Once you know that, I can say, okay, now this I might subject to the discrete Fourier transform, and then I get the ontological variable. I do that everywhere as much as I can. Where there will be already, right from the beginning, there will be one question, which is how to choose the phases in that case. And if you choose the phases differently, the templates that you get out of that might become different as well. So in other words, there's some freedom, very important amount of freedom, that you might have to take into account, which makes the job quite complicated.
What if you have two cellular automata that have the same energy spectrum, and then you can't differentiate between them?
In a cellular automaton, there you write e to the I A times e to the I B is equal to I C, but I can rotate the A and I can rotate the B, and then the final answer depends on those phase angles. So you see immediately that the answer might not be a unique Hamiltonian. In fact, all I really know about Hamiltonian is its eigenvalues, but I can shift the eigenvalues, I can rotate all the eigenstates differently. So so there's a lot of freedom. But of course, my problem will be find out one Hamiltonian that does the job right. If I find one, then I'll see if I can believe that model. Very often, in the case of this particle which had all these spectral lines miraculously aligned to be an equal staircase, in that model in particular, I find it very hard to identify the original coordinate with this alpha parameter. So there was technical problems all over. Although I call this talk simplicity of quantum mechanics, the actual calculations can be quite complex and also give answers that are not unambiguous. There are many different possible answers. What you really want, of course, is a result that makes sense physically. You say this particle interacts locally with other particles. So you want to keep locality as a guide. Suspect that this world obeys local laws of physics, it seems to us. I don't see any contradiction with locality, so it should be possible to arrange things such a way that you make your ontological law also local, a local law. But that's an extra complicated and important constraint that makes our problem very complicated to solve.
Thanks.
Thank you for the talk. It was really nice. I was wondering, so in this interpretation...
Where are you?
Here.
Ah, yes.
Sorry. In this interpretation, your entire universe is described by one ontological state.
Yes.
And when you make a measurement, you're making a measurement of, in a sense, a sub-ontological, like an ontological substate.
Yeah.
How do you combine your different measurements in this one big ontological system? Because you have several classical systems that you're going to be measuring at different times. How does that work?
I think a good strategy will be to do exactly as we do today, which is find the most appropriate model, like the standard model, that describes all we see. So please continue with figuring out what the standard model has, what kind of particles it has. Then I know the energy spectrum, and then from there on, it would be my task of friends or students of mine, to try to figure out whether there is an ontological theory that reproduces that spectrum.
But
I've shown roughly how some of these calculations, some of these arguments go, and you immediately see how difficult it is, and that there will be ambiguities in the final answers that are not obvious to avoid. So it will be hell of a job to figure out what the ontological theory behind it all is. But this is the whole idea of finding the hidden variables, which is like solving an inverse problem in mathematical physics. It's very, very hard, not logical at all, whether it's doable, but if you don't try, it's certainly not doable. So I propose that we should try for models such as a standard model, such as quantum gravity, to see if we can identify ontological states or an ontological approach that helps us understanding what is going on at a small distance level. And locality would be a very good guide, but maybe there are some non-local effects as well. This is something that remains to be figured out.
Thank you.
Any other questions?
It worked. I have a question of, you didn't talk about that, how you would make your picture compatible with the principle of relativity. So that is it clear that different boosted observers have the same sets of people, or do you have to, in fact, modify relativity to keep your picture?
That's a very important question. I could generalize the question. Relativity is invariance under Lorentz transformations, or covariance under Lorentz transformations. But there are many other symmetries. There's rotation symmetry. There is translation symmetry, but also many internal symmetries of particles. How do we reproduce those in these ontological theories? Answers, I don't know. It's very difficult. In fact, most models, the cellular automaton seems to require a preferred reference frame. Whereas most of us believe that special relativity is a fundamental symmetry of nature. So we should be able to get the same ontological variables by rotating the frame by Lorentz transformation. This, again, is something that's very difficult. And to my mind, it must be so that the Lorentz invariance is an emergent symmetry, a symmetry that's not in the underlying system, but emerges when you try to solve the equations. And that's the best answer I can give now. It's not inconceivable. I can think of many emergent symmetries. I'll give you a simple example. When you make a picture with your cell phone of whatever object, but you are holding your cell phone under an angle, so you want to straighten up the picture, you rotate the picture by any angle. In Google or any program, Photoshop, you just press a button and whoops, the picture appears like this. Yet the picture is made out of pixels. And those pixels didn't have that symmetry. How did they manage to rotate that picture? It's not so easy. But since the rotated picture is undistinguishable from the original one, they did a very good job of solving this problem. In spite of all the discretized pixels, they managed to make a way of rotating pictures without any difficulty. And so I'm suspecting if the people Photoshop can do that for photos, why should we not be able to do such a thing for particles that live on a grid of pixels and then rotate that, or even Lorentz transform that. Well, Lorentz transformation is a lot more difficult because the Lorentz group is a non-compact group. That makes the Lorentz invariance hell of a problem. And yes, it's one of my urgent problems that I would like to understand better how to solve.
Any other questions?
Again, about the whole input, I usually find, well, I've found in problems I've had that a problem is much more satisfying when you don't need to input that many elements in your theory. However, in this ontological perspective, it seems like you have your one theory, but finding your state basically requires you to have an infinite number of variables that you plug in compared to all, like from all of your measurements to find your ontological state.
I'm trying to, I didn't quite catch what you're asking.
So, standard model, for example, yeah, needs some number of constants and variables in it.
Okay. There is an important element here, is the universe we are looking at today, including the standard model, is basically a low energy limit of the entire reality that we're looking at. We don't know what happens between, say, one TeV and a Planck scale. That's just 20 orders of magnitude of unknown physics lying ahead of us. Strictly speaking, you can only write down ontological theory if somehow you have some information about those 20 orders of magnitude, or 10 or whatever, that we don't understand today. That's a hell of a complicated job. Now we're looking only at the lowest energy state. But you know, the energy spectrum is all these states are superpositions of many ontological states. The ontological states just hop from one to the next. They don't know what the energy is. So energy is obtained after doing this Fourier transformation. But now after making the Fourier transformation, we only understand the lowest energy states. Everything else is simply not known to us. So you understand how difficult it is to make an ontological theory. And maybe it will be impossible for quite a while, but it doesn't stop us from thinking about it.
Anyone else?